Code Fun Podcast Network.
This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Linode. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing your enterprise's infrastructure, Linode has the pricing, support, and scale you need to take your project to the next level. Get started on Linode today by going to linode.com/remoteruby.
This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Welcome back, Nate and Andrew. Jason, unfortunately, it sounds like he's at the hospital with his little one. Not coronavirus, but some virus. So hopefully he gets better soon. We'll have him back next week. But how are you guys?
I'm doing good.
I'm also doing good. I think it's worth mentioning that I think this is the first episode that's been done without Jason.
Yeah, it probably is. He's been around for, I think, almost everyone. He's kind of the staple to it. So we gotta fill his shoes this time. But yeah, how are you guys holding up from the all the panic and everything going on lately?
I'm hanging in there. Nice thing for me, I mean, I've been remote now for a year and a half, full-time remote. And so that aspect of my life hasn't really changed. Although the stores are pretty wiped out. It's hard to find some food items and even toilet paper and things like that. But other than that, we're doing good.
Yeah, same. And I'm always the last person to do anything, really. Like my friend told me that was going to be like my last words, or like, we'll give it one more day and see what happens. Because I'm like that with the hurricanes that come through too. Like, I won't leave. I've only left for one. And the one I did leave for, it was because my girlfriend's parents at the time would not stop calling me. It was driving me insane, begging me to leave. And I left in like the middle of the night, and I should not have left. I could have stayed. But same with this. I was not prepared to do anything different in my life because, yeah, I work from home. And my roommate called and she was like, they're shutting down the schools at 4. You need to go to the store now. And I was like, yep, you are correct. You are very correct about that. And I had to do that. And it was terrible. I hated every second of it.
Yeah, I haven't been out too much. There's not as much panic here in St. Louis, but yeah, it's starting to get there. There's like schools closing. I think this morning was finally like the state of emergency thing where it was like no events over 1,000 people, which unfortunately RailsConf is canceled. And I was going to go to MicroConf this year too. And same thing happened for it. So I guess we won't get to hang out in person this year at RailsConf.
That'll be interesting and a little sad. I was looking forward to actually meeting Andrew and you, Chris, and Jason, first time face-to-face. So
yeah, that would have been fun, but I don't know. It seems like, I don't know. I haven't gone to RubyConf. It didn't seem like they were planning on, I mean, because it's kind of unpredictable, like doesn't necessarily seem like they're going to just do this again. It's just like canceled, not necessarily postponed. But yeah, well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens with it. I know they're refunding me on my sponsorship for it and all that. So it's a little disappointing, but I mean, we'll get to hang out at some point here in the next, I don't know, in the next year, as long as we all survive, right?
Totally. We ought to call some attention to Andrew's experiment that he's been floating out there with a remote like meetup or possibly a conference. I don't know if you've taken the idea to a conference yet, Andrew, but you want to talk about that at all?
We talked about it a little bit last week, but it was supposed to be just an idea because I didn't think anyone would actually sign up for it. And this was kind of my like foolproof method of making sure, like telling people I tried, but there wasn't enough interest. But now I have like 200 email addresses in MailChimp and I don't know how to use MailChimp and I don't want 200 email addresses. And I'm like, dang it, now I might actually have to do something. Like I have companies have reached out and offered to sponsor it. And I'm like, sponsor what? I was like, I'm not a planner. I'm not a planner at all. I'm like, if you are a planner, I'm your worst nightmare. Like I have been told that verbatim. I'm not a planner. I'm a very chaotic person. So I'm trying to find a planner to help me with this.
So you're looking for some help basically on organizing the whatever it ends up being. Do you have an idea if you want to go do like a one-time meetup or like a actual online conference thing. I know we were looking at, was it Laracon Online? Is the Laravel mm-hmm. online? And it's actually like a conference thing you pay for, I believe. Right.
But it's really cheap. Like the early bird tickets are like $10 and the non-early bird is like $25. So
that's cool.
I'm going to regret everything I'm about to say, but I was eventually convinced by some people who were like, you know, now you have this great opportunity to do this. Like people are rallying behind you, like regardless of whether you wanted it to happen or not. And regardless of whether or not you want to do it, you were the one that did something. And they're like, that makes you the de facto. You're in charge now. And I was like, it would be kind of foolish of me to like look this opportunity like in the face and say no, because like CodeFund could get a lot of free publicity, personal, like, I don't know, meet more people. Like one of my mentors like really summed it up. He was like, if you didn't put this on and someone else did, would you go to it? And I was like, 100%. And he's like, so you want it to happen? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, there you go.
Like, yeah, get to work.
Yeah, but I was tossing this idea around with Andrew Femera of trying like a meetup type like thing like once or twice. And then if there seems to be momentum, go ahead and trying to do like a full on like one day conference.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good testing grounds. You don't have to ship the whole thing and get real sponsors or anything right away at the beginning. Cause then it also can be like, you could have 200 email addresses and then like 10 people show up and 190 like watch it later or something, if at all, you know? So I think that's probably a good idea because you don't want to spend too much time and have a low turnout or whatever. But I guess if you're selling tickets or something to it, you at least have an idea of exactly how many people want to attend because they're willing to give you $10 or whatever. So that's not a bad idea too, to maybe pre-sell something once you have a better plan maybe.
Yeah. The whole getting to the better plan part is the problem.
Yeah. It's got to be a lot to organize. And hopefully it's at least a lot easier than an in-person conference where you got to go find like a hotel or whatever to partner with and conference space, I guess. But
yeah, I'm going to slap a big we'll see on it, but I am pushing forward on at least trying to do the meetup thing.
Yeah, I really like the meetup idea. I mean, kind of like a little local meetup where you have got a couple people that are presenting, but not a production quite like a conference.
Yeah, yeah. And people keep telling me like getting speakers is going to be the hardest part. And I was like, really? Because like that does not seem like the hard part of this, because there's all these people that were going to present at RailsConf who now aren't. I had one person on Twitter today. They said that if they really want to do the talk that they were going to give, and I think it's an important topic, which I can't recall word for word, so I don't want to paraphrase right now, but they were like, I want to give this talk. If you're planning to do anything online, let me know. I want to give this talk. And I was like, I know enough people. I feel like it wouldn't be that hard to get like two or three people to like be down for like a 15 or 30 minute talk, even if it's pre-recorded.
Totally. Yeah. I'd be happy to give my rejected talk.
Yeah. That's good, because I was counting people in my head, put you on that list.
You've already been counting on that one now.
Yeah. I was like, well, if all fails, like at least Nate would do one, right? Hopefully.
It makes it really nice because like you have all these people who were going to give a talk somewhere at RailsConf, but now they can't. And there's not like there's no makeup date for it. So it's just like, well, they're kind of out. They don't have a place to give their talk anymore except for small meetups or something. So Yeah, seems like a great time to pick up speakers for it. So I guess they should tweet at you or something if they want to get in touch.
Yes, they should tweet at me until I find an assistant.
They tweet at you and say they want to be your assistant.
Yeah, if you want to be my assistant, like I have actually paid someone to do this in the past. when I was in college. That was my fun fact at my internship that later turned into my Rails job, that I had an assistant and I was in college and everyone looked at me like an idiot. But
that's awesome. I love it.
I didn't want to answer emails. I'm sorry. I was willing to pay for it.
There you go. That's good. Then at some point you're just hiring a developer to code for you and you don't have to do it either.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh yeah, I forgot that I wrote that code last week. Wink, wink.
That's how most of my code is anyway.
Oh, speaking of that, this morning we were chatting about standard RB on Twitter a bit earlier. I haven't ever used really a code formatter linter too much myself, but I thought Jumpstart Pro was probably a good place to begin, you know, maybe doing that because it's just a template that everybody's starting with. So if you have some sort of standardized format to that, in theory, you know, merging in random people's pull requests or whatever, because sometimes I'll get contributions from people in the community. It seems like it's probably a really good way to handle that. It's not an open source project, but it is one that has a lot of people that contribute to it. It's been pretty fun. And I know, Andrew, you have a lot of experience with standard now that you've been building the GitHub Action for it. You found that Jumpstart had quite a few violations or whatever on Jumpstart.
Yeah, a couple.
Yeah.
More than one.
I don't code to that exact standard normally on my stuff, but it's fun. Have you guys been liking using standard for stuff?
Nate, you want to go first?
Sure. So the one great thing about using something like standard, or you know, in the JavaScript world, there's prettier standard. And on CodeFund, we actually use a prettier standard for the JavaScript and standard RB for the Ruby. And overall, it's been a pretty pleasant experience. The real benefit that it provides is if you do have a project where there are multiple contributors, you eliminate a whole class of bike shedding in the, you know, with your developers about how are we going to format this or what's the best way to do that. And with the RuboCop linter as well, like sometimes you can identify hotspots in your code, or if you're doing something that's kind of inefficient, it will automatically format it to something that's a bit more efficient. And so you do get some of those benefits. The one thing that you do lose, and it does kind of irritate me sometimes, is you can't necessarily structure the code the way that you might want to in terms of optimizing it for readability or something like that. Because I don't agree with every rule that's in there. But I mean, that's kind of the point too, right? It doesn't matter if you agree, we're just going to standardize everything.
Yeah, and that was probably one of the big things that you see in my code when it complains about stuff, is like, I was aligning stuff visually so I could at a glance see it all aligned and pick out what I was looking for. And you know, like if you align the values in a hash all evenly, that I think it doesn't like, which makes sense. It's definitely like an annoyance to have to go and, you know, move stuff over if you add or remove a key that changes the depth of that. But like, you know, those are kind of the things that are like, to me personally, it's pretty handy to have that when I'm like looking for what data is in there regularly. But I can understand why it's probably not part of that default, but it is weird to kind of get used to some of those changes. Have you had like some of that where you're like, I don't really like this and I guess we'll just deal with it? Or is it just kind of like most of them are not that big of a deal?
For me, it's kind of like the convention over configuration, like Rails ethos, right? And so I remember when I first came to Rails from .NET, I mean, back in the .NET days, I mean, there wasn't any type of consensus on, you know, in the developer community of how to even like name your database tables or the fields in them or what foreign keys should be prefixed or not prefixed with, all that kind of stuff. And so you would spend days just arguing with your dev team about like what to name a particular column or what prefix you were going to use or suffix. And Rails was such a breath of fresh air because it eliminated all that bike shedding. And standard kind of does the same thing on the code side.
Yeah, that is something I guess you take for granted a lot in Rails and stuff, because you don't have to do that most of the time, where you're like, look, if I want to associate it with another table, I do table name, plural, underscore ID, or you know, that sort of thing. And you're good to go. And you don't ever think about it, which is like really nice. I remember doing that in stuff before where I'm like, wow, I named that really stupidly. And now it's going to be a real pain to like undo that. Standard did catch a couple funny things that were like, well, I do sometimes do a assignment in a conditional where I'm only going to need that variable in that part of the conditional. It did catch a couple things there, and then it definitely caught one that was like, what was it?
You symbolized true.
Oh yeah, symbolized the validation. It was like presence is symbol of true, not the word true or the keyword true, which was like, oh yeah, that was a good catch. Like that shouldn't have been that way. So it has been really nice to catch a few of those things where I'm like, oh, that's good. I really do like, I mean, the forcing parentheses around assignments in a conditional is good just to make sure that you don't accidentally assign something when you meant to check if it was equal to something else. Fixes typos or helps you catch typos a lot clearly or more clearly that way. You know, those things are really nice to be able to check for that, where you might make a little mistake here or there, or, you know, trying to quit Vim, you accidentally delete a character and break something or whatever. That's pretty nice to have. I like that. I saw you guys were using the ERB lint. Has that one been handy too?
I should probably preface that answer with saying that I will literally lint every single file in the code base with some linter as long as it will auto-format it for me. If I don't have to touch it and it will automatically do it, I will run a linter on it. I'm talking about Markdown, YAML, you name it, I will run a linter on it. Even language, I've run linters on language before. The ERB formatter, I wanted more of. There's really not a good... I want ERB to be formatted the same. I'm not going to do the HAML thing. I'm not going to go into it. But if you listen to the last episode of the Ruby Blend, I think it was episode 4. Nate wasn't there. Ron and I went for a good minute on HAML and ERB, but that's not the point. I want to press a button and I want ERB to all format. I want all the ERB to format because it, like, sometimes it just gets gross and like you're like, all right, I don't know. Where do I like tab this into and to, it doesn't just look gross? That was my hope for ERB linter. That's not really what it does. It will do a little bit of that. There's also something called, I'll have to find the actual name, but it's like an HTML beautifier, but it works with ERB that I use. That's not in the project, but I typically run that on the code, which is nice. But yeah, I think the ERB linter is helpful because it'll tell you things like, hey, you don't need to escape that. Or like you do need to escape that, like things like that. So it's been helpful for things like that. It can also run RuboCop on the code in your ERB, but since we're not using RuboCop, that's not really handy.
Yeah, I bet there's a lot of like interesting stuff that could be done in the ERB just because, I don't know, lots of people do queries in your ERB on accident or whatever. And I don't know if it can catch all that, but it's generally going to be, you know, stuff that you would hopefully be able to tackle, I would guess.
Yeah, it doesn't flag a lot, but like I said, if it's going to run automatically and I don't have to touch it, then I will run it. We have a bin stub that will run all the autocorrects on all the formatters that we use. We only use 3, but it will run them all, which is really nice. And I basically move that to all the projects I have now.
And then are you running that, like, you know, before your tests, like to fix stuff to validate stuff in your CI, just to make sure everything's formatted correctly before you even bother with a PR?
We do run it in CI. My workflow personally is I write the feature however the way I want to write it. Standard RB runs in my editor. I have it set to run automatically. So anytime I click off of the window or off of the editor pane of the file that I'm working on, my editor will save. And every time it saves, it will run the formatters for whichever extension that is. But I run the tests at the end and then I run the bin stub to standardize everything, and then I push it all up.
Gotcha. Do you also have, I mean, assuming, you know, it's open source and someone sends you a PR, then they don't necessarily have their editor set up the same way. You do check it in the CI or whatever?
I do. Yeah, we check it in. I always make sure that if I'm going to hold people to that, whatever standard that is that I'm trying to set, that it's very low barrier for them to use. Like the other day, I got a PR on RuboCopple interaction. Actually, it was the Ruby meetup website, and they wanted to change some of the language, and they opened a PR. Prettier hadn't been run. It flagged in CI, and I was just like, hey, could you, this looks good. Can you run Prettier on it? And then typically what I do is wait like a day or two, because usually most people are like, oh yeah, I'll do that real quick, because I make it so easy for them to run it. I just paste in the command. I'm like, yeah, can you just run this command real quick? So that's worked out for me. I think it's the most helpful on something that other people are going to use, because Julian, who we know, and he has a tractor gem. Is it Zibbles or Znibbles? I can't even pronounce it. It starts with a Z. He has a little community he's growing, and he's working on the Better Stimulus website as well. I was helping him with some stuff in a tractor, and I don't remember what it was. And I was like, I finally messaged him and I was like, dude, you do this thing that I'm trying to do 10 different ways in the same file. And I was like, I'm literally sitting here debating, like looking at all the different ways you're doing the same thing and trying to decide which one do you want it to be done like. And I'm like, you know, if you installed a linter, I wouldn't have to do this and I would have been done with this. And which is not a knock on him. Like, some people don't use them and that's like totally fine. But for a contributor, I was like, dude, I'm having to like sit here and think like way more than I should be having to think about how I'm going to like set up this array. Like, come on.
That's like a really good use case for it, because, you know, everybody's going to have their own focus whenever they're submitting a PR or something. And then as you're maintaining this, you have to worry about, is this code something that I understand that, or simple enough that other people can understand it and, you know, fix it? Because we have to fix any bugs. That person who made the PR may just disappear tomorrow, and now we are responsible for their code. So yeah, it seems like a really good, especially a good use case in open source to have a standardized format and use linters for that stuff. Do you see any, like, I was trying to think about this, like, you know, is it a good idea to, you know, maybe when someone pushes up to their branch on a PR, just automatically run the fix version of the command rather than like the check, you know, and see if it passes or fails? Like, is that a thing you've considered doing? And is there downsides to that?
This is my favorite question. Go ahead, Nate. You'll figure out why it's my favorite question quickly.
So you're saying just automatically running fix on those files?
Yeah.
Essentially, that's what we're doing. We have a bin stub that we've created to run all of our formatters. And it doesn't just do the checks, it actually runs the fixes as well. And
he's saying to do this in CI, like have Circle or GitHub Actions run the fix and
actually
then
run the fix
to the branch.
In CI and just send send a PR back to the PR.
Yeah, just add a commit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm curious, since you've been working on these actions, what your answer is going to be for this.
You see how he like kind of clenched his neck a little bit and he's thinking about how disgusting that was. I've had this discussion with a lot of people and I fall in a weird place on it, because I've done a lot of CI actions. I've messed with actions a lot. It seems like I'm always working on our CI setup. Number one, not for all languages. I have actually created, there is a PR, it's on a branch that I just didn't want to throw away. I built this in the RuboCopple interaction and the standard action that I have, that you could set a flag to do that. And the only reason I didn't merge it was, number one, because it wasn't a large amount of code, but it did introduce more questions downstream outside of the action. And I decided that I didn't want to have to think or have to take into consideration those downstream things. What if like I push up and it starts running the linters. It sees that it needs to fix it. It fixes it. It adds a commit. But in the meantime, I've remembered that I didn't run it and I'm pushing up a commit. And now you have issues up there. The other thing was I didn't want to, by putting it in there, I knew people would be encouraged to do it. And I didn't want to encourage people to do that. I wanted to do it just because I was like, hey, cool. I made this work. This is cool. This is like a fun technical challenge. I didn't want to encourage that as behavior because, like I said, it depends on the language. The RuboCop, because I used to use RuboCop for Nate. I joined CodeFund. You can't autocorrect everything with RuboCop. And sometimes when it does run autocorrect with RuboCop, it breaks things. So I definitely would never auto run RuboCop in CI. Standard, maybe. I probably would. It doesn't fix everything, but it fixes almost everything.
Oh, I was just going to throw out there, though, that standard RB is actually built on top of RuboCop.
I know. I don't understand. Justin has really like so many like configuration options. Like creating standard was genius. It's like the goodness of RuboCop without any of the configuration. If you're already running standard, if the project is already on standard, I would run standard. Yeah, I would do it. Prettier, I would do prettier. I would never do ESLint. Go doc. Yeah, I mean, not go fump, whatever it's called. Like it depends on the action. And because it depends, I decided not to add it because I don't necessarily think it's a good idea. I didn't want to encourage it.
Yeah, it makes sense. If it's like, I mean, I would assume from what I saw in standard, it's like, it's not going to like try and fix stuff that it's unsure of or whatever, but yeah, there's probably situations where it will, I would imagine, try to fix something, but accidentally break something. It's just like too complex of a problem to be able to do that perfectly 100% of the time. Like one of the examples just was, and this was a couple things that popped up in when we ran it on Jumpstart so far, like when you're doing a conditional and you have an assignment in there, it doesn't know if you just made a typo, trying to check if it was equal or not. So you want to wrap that in parentheses if it's on purpose, or you want to fix your conditional because you're doing something wrong and assigning a local variable then. And it doesn't know. It's just like, hey, you want to be careful with this. So if you put parentheses around it, we know for sure you want to do that properly. And there's also some implications or whatever with the way Ruby evaluates it that you do want to put parentheses around the assignment so that it's evaluated correctly. So that was a good one that I was like, oh yeah, but it's not able to fix that. You know, it would still fail even if it did, you know, auto fix the rest of things, you know, and then it, what's that do? You know, I guess it would trigger. So if you had it run the fix automatically, then it pushes up a commit, then it triggers the CI again to check again, and you might be able to get into a fun infinite loop of CI running forever. That'd be kind of fun.
So I think I think you're starting to trigger some deja vu. I think we've actually had this conversation in the past, and you brought up the exact same concern. And when you said that, I was like, oh, that's a really good point. And my way of fixing it was any commit pushed up by an action had a specific, like I prefixed the commit message. And so when the action would rerun on the new commit. Also, back then when I was doing this, if GitHub pushed a commit, it wouldn't rerun the actions, which I considered a bug, but whatever. It might be fixed now, I don't know. But I told it to skip it, not rerun it. Because yeah, you're right. You could totally get into a loop.
That's funny. Yeah, I deal with some of that on Hatchbox where like someone will have a deployment that runs for... Sometimes I'll check and Sidekick's got a deployment that's run for like 4 days. And I'm like, well, I guess I have to kill that. And yeah, I imagine that it gets pretty tricky for them to manage all those jobs that are running and whatever on CI and all that. Because it's not just running tests. It's like you can do anything you want in GitHub Actions, which is cool. I did recently update to the Ruby... What is it? The official Ruby GitHub action step thing?
Yeah.
That's so much faster than the official GitHub one. And I don't really even understand exactly why like the GitHub one exists. It's like, it should just be deprecated and tell you to go use the other thing.
They do that, actually. Okay, well, this was very interesting. I don't know if y'all know this, but there is a bit of contention in the Action community. I say this with quotes. The official GitHub Action for Ruby was like versions behind. You couldn't use the newest versions of Ruby. I think anything past 2.6.3. And then, so the community started like creating workarounds, but because you're not taking advantage of the GitHub has like an extra layer of caching for those officially supported actions. So you were missing out on that. And then you were having to do weird things. Like I saw people installing RVM in an action. They would download RVM into the action and then RVM install.
Yeah, I saw one of those. It was like, yeah, it'll add an extra 10 minutes compile time on your actions. But I was like, why would you ever want it to spend 10 minutes compiling Ruby every time you push up? It's horrible.
Yeah, and that was also before they had actual caching for like your dependencies. But someone in the community, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce their name, also because I can see their face, but I can't remember their name exactly. They created a very popular, basically alternative to the GitHub one. And what ended up happening is that GitHub basically merged that in, and that became what is now the GitHub like supported action for Ruby. And it will allow you to get like the Ruby versions that you'll need.
Huh.
Plus the caching. That's,
yeah. Yeah. It seemed like when it came out, it was like strangely half thought out because no caching was real weird to launch at the very beginning. It's like a critical feature of like a fast CI or a Jenkins like service or whatever. And I thought that was strange. But yeah, when it was like, yeah, we support Ruby 2.6.3, not even the latest one, and we have no plans on maintaining this in the future. It was like, what was your point here? It was just an example, I guess. It was kind of strange. But luckily, that's all kind of fixed up now, it seems like. This reminds me of, what was it? I was trying to get, so GitLab CI, there was something with that for Jumpstart where I was trying to get it so that if you had a fork of Jumpstart Pro, it would run the tests on your merge request. But there were some permissions thing where like running, yeah, that's what it was. It was like secrets. Secrets get real tricky on forks. Where it was like, how do you properly not leak the secrets? Because you need to probably run the secrets against your code. But then if someone forks your repo and then just changes the script to just print out your secrets, you've leaked your secrets. You know, that's a ridiculous, like, you know, security problem. So I was like surprised that there wasn't any solution from it that I could see. I would have assumed that you could lock down the results or something to just the repository owners or something. But if someone's merging a pull request, then they can't see the output and why their CI failed or whatever. So that wouldn't be great either. And I realized like, man, this is a lot more tricky than it seems on the surface level. Like you think it would just be easy to say, hey, just always run the tests. And, you know, show us the output. But if someone's using it maliciously, it's a kind of dangerous thing.
Yeah, it's the same with GitHub Actions. It's kind of frustrating until you start thinking about the security implementation. And then, it becomes like this massive problem that I wouldn't even want to fix. I'm like, yeah, forget it. But yeah, that's also a problem. I didn't fix it, but I created I think it works on PRs. I don't know. I basically started limiting the things like, okay, we're not going to run these on. The nice thing about GitHub Actions is you can specify whether it runs on a pull or a push, a pull request or a push state event. If you forked the repository and you open a pull request and you're pushing to your pull request, it does not consider that to be a push. So only if you have ability to edit the repo will it consider it a push. So that's been my way of basically saying like, okay, these are going to run. I want these to run. They don't need, there's no secrets or anything, but the other ones aren't going to run because they're always going to error if it's someone editing it.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Man, yeah, it is way more tricky than it seems on the surface. Nate, you mentioned before the episode some cool local cash stuff that you've been doing on CodeFund. I'd love for you to give us an intro on all that and tell us what you've been up to.
Sure. So, yeah, I would say if you have built a Rails app that reaches a particular level of scale, then in all likelihood, you've either set up Redis or Memcached as a caching backend, as opposed to just storing all of your Rails cache in local memory. And that's true of like a distributed deployment, right? If you're running multiple web servers, you need some centralized like appliance tier that's actually serving your cache as a backing store. And then everything converges there, and then the shares, then the caches or those values that you put there are shared across all of the servers that are accessing it, which is pretty standard. I mean, pretty typical. I'd say most Rails apps of a particular size are doing that. And CodeFund is no different. So we've got a Redis backing for our Rails cache. And we also use Redis for queue, and we've got two distinct clusters, one dedicated to the queue, one dedicated to the cache. But even those Redis cache reads can be expensive. I mean, not that expensive. I mean, they may take 50, 60 milliseconds, you know, worst case, to go fetch even more computationally expensive data that you may have put up there into the cache. And we've been seeing that. And we've got enough traffic volume at CodeFund where it makes a lot of sense to cache a lot of things, but we were starting to see those Redis reads taking upwards of 60 milliseconds. Obviously, if it weren't cached, it would be even slower than that. So we created another caching mechanic that actually runs local to every process that has spun up. And so there's an in-memory local cache that we now set up with an initializer that still is a Rails cache object. It's a memory store Rails caching object. We instantiate that and then basically hang it off of the Rails global. Just like Rails cache, we now have Rails local cache that we can access. And the idea is that can eliminate some of the Redis reads because we can now layer it. So we can start with the local cache, read it out of local cache, that then will drop down. If we miss the cache key there, then we fall down to the Redis cache. And we'll pick it up out of the standard Rails cache that we have backed by Redis. And what we've found by putting that on some of our higher traffic endpoints, we've actually reduced request time on some of those by up to 100 milliseconds in some cases. So we've just eliminated, essentially took out a big chunk of Redis reads that happen over the course of a minute. And these things are pretty short-lived. So we're using the local cache. And for those things that are very heavily hit, we only hold the key in memory for 1 minute. But it's enough to give us a almost 50% savings in those very expensive endpoints. Works really well for, if you're doing computationally expensive things where you're iterating as well, even just little one-off active record lookups can be cached in this way. And on an iterative cycle, which we experience as well on our data seeds, you can see drastic performance improvements on those types of things.
Man, that's really cool. Because, I mean, 60 milliseconds isn't slow, but it's also like, if you're trying to get to 200 milliseconds or less, then that is a huge percentage of your time there already gone for the one piece. So that is a really great idea. Are you going to have to throw more RAM at your servers at a point, or just be careful about what you store in that local cache just so that you're not overloading your server's RAM?
Yeah, you need to be thoughtful about that. But the nice thing about the memory store cache object that Rails provides out of the box is you can set a maximum upper limit of how much memory you will allocate to that thing. And we're currently hosted in a way where we've got a lot of excess memory. I was still pretty conservative. Like I doubled the default, which I think was 32 megs. So we've got 64 megs that we will allow to go in there. And so it's kind of treated like a least recently used cache as well. So anything that isn't being accessed frequently, eventually it will just slide off then.
Yeah, and 64 megs on a server these days is not a whole lot when you've got, your Rails app is going to use whatever it uses, a gig of RAM or something, and then you have multiple processes up. But, that sort of thing is like way larger than 64 megs of RAM for each one of the... That's a good question. Is that a 64 megs shared between all the processes, or is that per process, I guess?
Per process.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about scaling up that, it's just, tack that extra onto what you would normally set your concurrency to or think about. So that makes just it easy to scale.
And then just be thoughtful about how much data you're putting into it and where you cache and stuff like that. But we found that layering it has been really helpful on some of those heavy hit endpoints. I mean, we've got some endpoints. If you think about it, the data needs to stay pretty fresh. But if you're making we're dealing on our ad endpoints anywhere from like 2,000 to 6,000 requests per minute. And so even by just caching it, where we only go to Redis once per minute when the cache key is old or stale in the local, we're eliminating, essentially 4,000 Redis reads every minute.
Yeah, which is phenomenal. Yeah, and I was also going to say, because you were layering it with a central cache, you don't have to worry about, it's not like you're calculating it. If someone makes a request and then goes to another server, the next request or whatever, that you wouldn't want to be inconsistent. Because you have the Redis cache as your backing, it will always be a central cache and always those local caches will just be kept up to date with that. And you don't have to worry about inconsistencies between, hitting a different process or whatever that's got a different cache. So it keeps that almost seamless. You don't have to even worry about that, which is really cool.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the implementation was really simple, and in terms of like our logic changes or anything, there really wasn't much. It was just kind of nesting one more indentation level with a cache fetch call. And the only thing we've really noticed is everything's much faster.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple solution to what would be a very complicated problem to try and improve your performance of Redis or whatever to the equivalent speed would just be a nightmare, of work. So it's a really creative solution to that probably has limitations at some point. But honestly, you can throw a few more bucks at a server and voila, you have a lot more RAM to do your local cache. Did you build like a helper around that or something that's just like your own cache helper that you can call that will automatically do the layering? Or are you just using both in your views?
Yeah, right now it's explicit. So the local cache method hangs off of Rails itself, the Rails global. And then I essentially added, just to make it a little less verbose, I delegate the local cache method to Rails from like my controllers and from my models and stuff like that. So everybody can just reference local cache and do the caching that way.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it's simple enough that way that does exactly what you need. And I think that's probably another good point of people often forget the Rails configuration is like a thing you can add your own configuration variables to. It's just like it's an object, but you can store new things in there just like a hash, And it's cool to be able to be like, yeah, we'll just throw in rails.localcache as well as the regular Rails cache we expect. And then we know, we can access it exactly the same way. And now we've introduced two caching mechanisms in Rails, which is pretty cool. I haven't done that a whole lot. I mean, most of the time you see that used in a gem that's extending Rails with some configuration options like action text or active storage will throw in some extra things or whatever. But it's nice to be able to actually use that as your own configuration. It is your app, so you should be able to do whatever you want with it. I like that.
Yeah, you just need to be thoughtful about naming collisions. So I actually gave this one a really kind of ugly name because I wasn't sure if at some point in the future Rails may introduce something like a local cache, because there's Rails cache and Rails local cache seems like it might be common enough where it might get added at some point. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a name that I know won't collide with anything. So it's called local ephemeral cache.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great... It's the same for monkey patching and stuff. It's like, just be careful with your naming so that it doesn't have a strong chance of conflicting in the future, because that would be a weird thing to hit, because you'll probably like, you know, pull down the latest Rails and then all of a sudden weird things are breaking and you don't know why. And it turns out that was your fault. And then the other thing you can probably do, and you see it a lot, is like do it in a nesting of, you know, rails.config.codefund or whatever, you know, that sort of thing can work too. But, you know, it doesn't really matter either way. You're going to have just a little bit more, I guess, complex of a name just to prevent naming collisions later on, which isn't too bad.
Yeah, I mean, you could also just hang it off of your own, you know, constant or something. So we could set up a codefund global at the top level namespace and just hang it off of that as well. And then we'd avoid all those types of problems. But it's kind of nice to just make it feel like it's just part of Rails.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Especially when it comes to caching, it's one of those things that feels like it is kind of built in to Rails. And then it also seems like something you could easily extract to a gem that just adds that local cache to the Rails configuration. And really, that's probably all it really needs to do, an initializer or a Rails engine to go and append that memory store. It'd be a cool little gem to extract, I bet.
Yeah, yeah, I've actually been thinking about that. It's a useful enough pattern. Like, it's really helpful to alleviate that back pressure that you may have on your, you know, your backing cache store or whatever you've set up. That it probably will. This will probably live as a gem at some point.
Yeah, I love it. It's like, you know, you don't have to do a... It's just something that reduces, like, you can throw a connection pool at stuff and add read replicas or whatever and go a complex route, or just have this little local cache. And as long as you're not maxing out your server's RAM, there's plenty of room for that. Or if, I mean, it definitely a case of like, you might have just tons of unique things cached and it may not be a huge benefit because you might always have cache misses if there's, you know, too many unique things. But as long as you have consistent stuff that'll fit in 64 megs or whatever you've got, then it's like extremely efficient, which is really nice.
Yeah, I do like your idea. And I'll have to explore this once I start pushing this over to like a library. But I like the idea of making some little helpers to facilitate that. So you maybe there's just a layered cache method that you could call to fetch, or like there's a layered cache fetch or something that's just built right into it.
Yeah, because then you can just have the cache key as your argument and then pass that directly into those. And that way it's consistent through everything and it would make sense. And then you just, you know, include that in application controller or application helper or something and you're good to go. I imagine that would be pretty easy and then a real easy extraction and a gem for people to pick up and use like right away.
Yeah, the hard part there would just be kind of documenting all of the reasons and best practices and that kind of stuff. I mean, there'd be a lot more documentation than there would be actual code in the library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine that was... it's just a... I mean, the size of the cache will be small, so it's like your CPU's cache. Like, there's only very limited data you can put in here, so, you know, that may also be a good thing where it's like, just use this cache for small things that are consistently cached throughout your app. Like, you know, if you have stuff that's cached for every logged out user that's consistent, maybe it's your navigation or something, if it's dynamic, then throw that in there. It's not going to change very often, but like the bigger stuff or things that do change often, probably not a great place for it because it'll push the other more persistent stuff out, which would suck. So, but I guess if you're clearing it, that'll come down to is like how often your expiration is, like 1 minute, you know, may be great for some situations, may not be great for others or whatever. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what use cases would work best.
Yeah, what default TTL on that local cache is only 1 hour. So that's the length that anything will default in there.
Gotcha. Yeah, That's a cool idea. I love it. I had never thought about layering caches like that, but it's a great solution for like such a simple implementation. Like it's not hard to add and, you know, revert if you ever run into issues or whatever, but you're not making major changes and you get a pretty big win on speed there. So that's pretty cool. I love that. You reminded me of the like global, like not Rails constant or whatever, but it was doing multi-tenancy stuff lately on Jumpstart Pro and having current account as like the current attributes thread local variable. And that stuff has been, it's been interesting to say the least. It's like nice to have, but you can so easily get that out of sync because it's something that you have to set per request and then reset it at the end of the request. Whereas this would be a much better situation for something like that. That's going to be kind of a global. It's persistent all the time throughout all your processes and threads and everything versus like the current attribute stuff that is like intended to be temporary.
Yeah. You know? I didn't think of using it as like a replacement for current attributes, but yeah, you could because it's in memory. It's all in memory. So you can stuff like non-serializable objects into it. And I mean, you can load up a whole collection of active record instances and stick it in there and it's then doesn't, I mean, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been throwing trying not to encourage people to use it too much. So we will like take the devised current user and throw it in there and current account if you're doing multi-tenant stuff. And that works well. But there's little things of like, you know, the join table on a current user and the current account, do we save that in there? And then if you set user before account, then we need to check in that case. But then also if you set account first before the user, we need to also assign this account user. And it seems like a good way for things to get really messy or data to be out of place. So I would try to be limiting on my usage there where like, if you want to look up the current account, we'll look it up when you ask for it. We won't query for that ahead of time. We could and assign it to there, but then we'd have to check every case where account might get set before user and so on. It just seemed like something that like gets messy and out of hand sooner than later. So the current attribute stuff is maybe nice, but also seems like it's kind of a pain.
I'm actually using it on another project pretty extensively, current attributes. It works really well. One thing that I did do that is kind of interesting because I'm using Stimulus Reflex on that project. And so I've got some need to essentially reset up an existing current and like resaturate current in a background job for a user who may be logged into the site at that moment. But I'm outside the context of a web request. And so what I did is I implemented global ID on current so that I can serialize that down to a string and then just basically find the current based on the serialized ID. And so I basically will take a user and put it, their current serialized current as a global ID into their session. And then on the back end, I can say, well, this user is the one that's requesting the thing. So go look in the cache or in session for their, actually I'm using cache in that case, but I go to the cache, fetch the current global ID, and then I just resaturate current from there.
Oh, that's really nice. So you store your whatever IDs or whatever in the global ID so that it can look it up again.
Yep.
That's cool. Yeah, because this, I don't remember if you were on, I think we talked about it last episode maybe. The devised masquerade gem is got these, you know, tokens to log into someone else. And those tokens obviously are like dangerous to share. So they have a expiration of a minute. And I was looking at the implementation because it was doing weird stuff for me. And that has, it stores them in the Rails cache for a minute and then they expire. And I realized like that doesn't work if you don't have the Rails cache enabled. And what I was working on didn't. So I can never log in as that user. And I went and refactored that gem just to use a signed global ID so I could set an expiration of 1 minute. And it was like, this is so nice because you have a way to reference literally any, you know, class. It doesn't have to be a database thing that you load from it. You just need to have the parameters in this string and then it can load anything, which is really cool. So I've been really like thinking about global ID a lot more because it's a nice way to reference kind of anything where you can serialize it, but only what's necessary to like rehydrate the class next time you need it, which is, it's so cool. I was like, I think I took it for granted when they released it because I didn't realize like how useful it would be. But now that I've been using it a few times, and I think Action Text was the reason that like it basically will pull out your embeds and then store them as global IDs so it can rehydrate your HTML with fresh, you know, if you change the format of an embed, it will always render the latest format. And that is the way it does it, which I realized like, this is like super practical because initially I thought it was a way to just do like a polymorphic relationship, but very simple. And I was like, that's fine, but it's kind of, I don't understand why we need it. But now that we've used it like outside the database a lot, it is really awesome. I love it.
Yeah. If you haven't taken a look at Global ID, I highly encourage people to go look at it and try to build your own object that implements Global ID. It's so powerful. It's really cool.
Yeah. And it's simple, you know, like just throw the locator in there and inherit from the class. And there's not a lot you need to do.
Yeah.
When are you going to push that gem up, Chris? Because ever since we talked about this last week, I have noticed a lot more things with devise masquerading that's now driving me batty.
Yeah, I need to do that. It was just sitting in my branch and my fork or whatever. But yeah, I think it probably warrants. Like, I understand why they may not want to, you know, change the core way that it works right now. But I don't really see any downsides to replacing that mechanism inside. So yeah, maybe I'll do that after this episode and just release a new gem. You got to give me a name for it though. So
I will think about a name.
Cool. It just seems like it's such a simple little improvement. And you know, like, I think I showed you the PR. It was like, we'll delete like 40 lines of code and replace it with just 5 or something. And it's way simpler that way, which is nice. And it functions basically exactly the same. You just don't need the Rails cache enabled anymore either. So.
Yeah, real quick while he's gone. When Nate was talking about all those caching things, he used the word we a lot because Nate is a good leader. There was no we involved in that. Do not ask me any question about anything he said because I have no clue. He also kind of downplayed the actual impact because our response times were hanging around really kind of in between 150, around 150 milliseconds. And this is not like this Scout and it's not getting all of our data because, or all of our requests because they don't have a plan that's big enough to support how much we would be sending them. And it was hanging around 150. It's been hanging around 150. It actually got higher and now it's 33.
Wow. That is fantastic. And that was all from that one change.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. That is cool. Well, there you go. That I think absolutely warrants a gem or something just as a new way to approach, you know, local caching. It just seems very obvious in hindsight now, having heard it, that it would make a lot of improvements there. Saves an entire network round trip and whatever else that Redis needs to do and so on. So that's slick. I like it.
Nate, you weren't selling it. I had to sell it.
Good.
Yeah. Being way too modest.
One, two punch. Yeah.
Using too much we. There was no we. Sure. I don't understand. I don't think I told you this. Justin wanted some content for the blog and I sent him something and he's like, well, we're not actually using that. Like, it wouldn't really make sense for us to post that. And he's like, what do you know about this? And he posted your screenshot of like the drop off in Scout, like how faster, how much faster that everything got. He's like, what do you know about this? And I was like, I know enough to sit in the same room as Nate explains it and nod along.
Now you're underselling yourself.
No, I've never done caching before. I've never really worked on a scaled app. So every time I hit caching stuff, I'm like, oh, this is some usually new territory for me.
Yeah, it seems like one of the things that takes a while to get used to thinking about that way, just because there's a lot of nuance to it, you know, that you can get bit with. Like the other day, I forgot that on Go Rails, I have the like forum threads or comment threads loaded dynamically. And, you know, they're nested comments on episodes, which means that like underneath each one of those, I'll render the comment form, but I of course can't cache that, which means I can't do Russian doll caching where I cache the entire thing, unless I was to go through and like update with some JavaScript, like go through and like replace all the authenticity tokens when the page loads or something. And I was like, I don't really want to do all that. And it's not totally worth, you know, like my site's pretty simple, but loading some of that was slower than I wanted it to be. And I was like, maybe I'll go and cache all that. So I did. Then I forgot about those little things. And then like comments break. And I realized, oh yeah, it's of course, as always, you know, never as simple as you want it to be when you start caching. But when you're like always thinking in that mindset, it becomes a lot easier because you're like, well, we'll cache it default in development. And then, you know, any of these bugs hopefully will start to crop up in local development sooner than you catch them in production, which is not always the case, but sometimes you get bit with one of those that you finally get to catch in production that you missed in development or whatever. But yeah, it is a different mindset, I feel like, sometimes.
I want to mention real quick, I have run Rails cache clear in production, not at CodeFun, but I've run that method before because something was cached. I didn't know what the developer who wrote it wasn't awake yet and the app was broken. And me and another junior were like, dude, I was like, I don't know. Like, I feel like we could run this and it's going to fix the issue we're seeing. I was like, I don't know what's going to happen when we run this. Like, what else is going to happen? This is not just going to fix the issue we're having.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some times where like, you know, well, a lot of times in big production sites, like the whole site requires a warm cache to be, you know, reasonable whatsoever. So doing that can be a fun experience to watch just how slow the whole site actually is.
This is a quick side tangent. I'm not going to rant about this, I swear. I was putting off actually organizing things for this upcoming meetup idea thingamajigger, whatever you want to call it. And I was adding some stuff to the rubymeetup.online site and I added dark mode. And I put a CodeFun ad on it. So I actually got it to the point where if you changed your like default coloring from like light to dark on Mac, not only would it update the site to be dark, it would also update the CodeFun ad to be a dark template as well. So I was very happy with myself until I realized that because of the way this is all getting done with JavaScript, when the site first loads, document is not available yet. So it flashes. It freaking flashes from light to dark on the first load. And I got it so that I could save like whether it was dark or light in like a local storage value, but that first load, or if you're on slow network, it's going to flash and it's driving me freaking batty. And it drove me so batty that I was like, I'm done with this. I'm done here.
That's that someone needs to make a PR for you and fix that, huh?
Please, dear God. I hate it so much. I'm not even sure, like, because it pisses me off so bad, even though it's noticeable, but like not something you're going to look at again twice, but it pisses me off so much.
Yeah, it's one of those that you're aware of the bug and it bothers you a lot, but you know, like in reality, people aren't really going to care about this too much, but it'll drive you insane anyways. It's like all the programming, huh? Well, I guess that's about it for this week. So have a good weekend, guys. Don't go to any gatherings of 1,000 people or more. And yeah, just don't go outside, really. I think that's the conclusion.
Best wishes to Jason and his family. Hopefully, hopefully they get that resolved quickly.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, I know that they're at the hospital or whatever, so it should be, you know, the best place they can be right now, I would hope, but...
Really? Yeah. I don't agree with that statement at all, actually. That's the worst place you could be.
Maybe, yeah. You just need a private doctor at home. That's what you need.
Yeah, I hope Putty is slinging them stacks over to Jason so he can get that private doctor.
Yeah, we'll get Instacart doctor delivery in 1 hour or less. Well, cool. I guess we'll talk to you guys next week.
Sounds good. We'll see ya.
See ya. Bye.
This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Linode. With 11 data centers worldwide, including their newest data center in Sydney, Australia, enterprise-grade hardware, S3-compatible storage option, and their next-generation network, Linode delivers the performance you expect at a price that you don't. Get started on Linode today by going to linode.com/remoteruby.